This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
If you will. That way it's going to lay some groundwork for what some of your goals may have been in writing the book, and I think the readers need to know that.
Well, thank you very much. There is a brief history of the Pentecostal movement in my book, by the way. Anyway, this is the introduction. I'm now reading it verbatim right out of the book. So Sister Paula is going to tell all. The rumble coming over the telephone wires wasn't the bombs bursting on Washington. It was a longtime friend having himself a belly laugh. You may be shocked by some of it, I fired back. It takes a lot to shock me. Just the same, take this from me. You ain't heard nothing yet. Go to it, Paula. For years I have been waiting to be told how you survived for more than 7 decades. There's not another person like you on the planet. I can count on you to tell the truth. 2 things have gotten me through: God's protection and my sense of humor. This book is the life journey of a transsexual seeking acceptance. There are some things I would just as soon not tell. Joan Rivers once told a guest on her network television show, "No one can smear you if you have told the story yourself." Authors of the Bible did not cover up the sins and mistakes of individuals who were mightily used of God. A researcher won't have to look far to discover the sins of Sister Paula. Yet the greater fact is that the historian will also discover many wonderful spiritual victories of Sister Paula. Through it all, God's hand has remained on my life. While on this journey, I have made a few poor choices. However, I have never regretted the decision to change my identity from Larry to Paula. Paula is who I am. I'm not, quote, confused, unquote, about my gender identity. In my growing up years, I was expected to dress and act a certain way and participate in specific activities. Many of my innate desires went contrary to those expectations. Somehow, I had the courage to be me. Shortly after I started the Sister Paula Public Access television program, a man wrote me a letter that said, quote, "I am shocked to see a female impersonator on TV pretending to be a God-fearing woman of God," unquote. He was wrong. I am not impersonating anybody, nor am I pretending to be anything. Someone once told me that I can be an entertainer or a preacher, but I cannot be both. I respond to this with a Chinese proverb: those who say it cannot be done should not interrupt the person doing it. Unquote. Four things I have never questioned. 1, my born-again experience and baptism with the Holy Spirit. 2, my call to preach the gospel. 3, my being transsexual. And 4, the angelic protection on my life as promised in Psalms chapter 91, specifically verses 3 and 11. In this book, there are shared experiences that readers will have to believe because no one could possibly make them up. This is my story exactly as I remember it.
Very good. Thank you. Now, I want to go back here towards the front of the book, and since you've laid out a foundation as to where you're going with this book and what you want to accomplish through it, you list this book being dedicated to 4 people and 4 women that I'm somewhat familiar with, probably more familiar with one than the others. But why don't you touch on that? What did they have? What kind of an effect did they have on you that you would want to dedicate a book to them?
Well, it's very interesting because 2 of the ladies that I dedicate my book to, I dedicate it to their memory, were preachers, and two were entertainers. And so that kind of there is a little bit of, throughout my life's journey, there's a little bit of all four of them that are a part of me, of the being the whole person as who Paula is. Sophie Tucker was a great entertainer back in the days of burlesque and vaudeville and nightclubs right up till 1966, the last of the Red Hot Mamas. And when I worked at Darcel 15 here in Portland in the 80s, that's who I emulated. I was billed as Portland's own Red Hot Mama, and that is a part of Paula, who I am. The other entertainer was Janis Joplin, whom I got into in the 70s. And Janis Joplin, I never met in person, but Janis Joplin grew up in a small town in Texas where she was kind of like a beatnik and a hippie before there was such a thing, and she was kind of ostracized as the one who was different. So I relate to her in a powerful way, and I find a deep, powerful, charismatic spirituality in the music of Janis Joplin. And the two people that know me real way say that all four of these women are embedded as a part of me, Sophie Tucker and Janis Joplin, and then Amy Semple McPherson, that great lady of faith who founded the International Church of the Four Square Gospel. And I went to her church in the 60s as Paula, by the way, the church that Amy McPherson built, and I became very familiar with her life and ministry. And then Catherine Kuhlman, many of you remember her. Catherine Kuhlman's ministry ministered to me for years. If I have any mentor as far as being a preacher is concerned, Catherine Kuhlman would be it. All four of these women were very powerful, charismatic persons who played a profound effect on my whole life's journey over a period of 7 decades.
Okay, let's step back to Amy Semple McPherson, because you indicate in your book that you attended the church in LA where she ministered, and you did this as Paula.
Yes.
What would have been the circumstances if the folks at church would have realized Paula was actually born male?
They probably would have rejected me. And that I was in my second and third years of living as Paula is when I went to Angela's Temple. I sang in the choir as Paula. They had no idea that I was trans, that I was formerly, you know, Larry. I sang in a ladies' chorale and even in a tall girls' trio. And I was secretary to one of the ministers on the staff there. And I knew that if those people knew that I was biologically male, they probably would reject me, but I knew that God knew. God knows all. God is an all-knowing, omniscient God, and that God knew, and I knew in my heart of hearts that God accepted me.
Well, and, you know, the funny thing about that, Paul, is where, as an individual, you can know that, you can accept that, you can believe that, but when you're talking about people who are around you that you expect to have to believe you, there has to be some sort of inner tension going on there in terms of how you dealt with that, because you know that they would not be as accepting and as forgiving as a forgiving God would be.
Right. Yeah, well, I wasn't coming from a space, well, sure, I sure fooled them. That never entered my mind. I was just being myself. I was just, you know, I was simply being myself and living in the identity that was comfortable to me. And I had found Christ as my Savior when I was a teenager, and when I was actually 12 years old. And that experience has never left me. And God's call was still stayed up to preach, still stayed on my life, even after I changed my identity in 1963. And so I was comfortable with that. But yeah, there was a little bit of nervousness about it. There were some gay people in the church there that may have had a good idea. I ran into some of them years later in 1978 at a gay church conference, and they weren't at all surprised to see me there. But nonetheless, if they did have an idea, they never said anything.
Right.
And they, so, but I those were some of the happiest moments of my life in Angela's Temple, where I was treated like any biological woman would be treated and not just tolerated as an innately effeminate boy.
Sure. We're going to talk about a fifth woman that came into your life. But before we do that, we're going to take a brief time out. You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm Dan Johnson. My guest today is Sister Paula. And we're back. Thank you very much. Paula, in I believe it was about 1952, my dad came home from work, and I was just a little squirt at the time. And he had this newspaper in his hand, and he said, "I've just read the weirdest story of my life." And my mom said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "There is a woman or a man, I'm not sure which it is, but this man was in the army. He was discharged, and then he announced he was going to Sweden to have a sex change."
Denmark.
Denmark, okay. And that was Christine Jorgensen. When you heard about Christine Jorgensen, what was your reaction?
That was the first time that I knew that I wasn't alone. You know, Christine, the publicity of Christine, she was the first sex change, male to female transsexual, to be openly publicized, who went through the whole change. And that was in 1952, like you said, when I was a freshman in high school. I'd always had been called, even before that, as far back as I can remember, from being 4 and 5 years old up to that point when I was a freshman in high school, I was always considered, I was made fun of, I was teased, I was called a fairy, I was called a sissy, and everything that I just innately, naturally liked to do, I was, my dad especially said, "No, only girls do that," and so I had no idea up to that point that there was anybody else in this on the whole planet that felt the same way I did, and there was a period of isolation and aloneness that was broken when Christine's story, that I remember the day as if it was yesterday, when the announcement came on the radio. On the television, had the picture of her in the army uniform, and then the picture as a woman, and said the man that became a woman. And then her story came out in the Oregonian in a 3-part series in the Sunday paper. When I read Christine's story, it was like I was reading about myself as far as her inner feelings go. And then because of that, because Christine had the courage to come out in the open with that, I knew that I wasn't alone, that there were other people that felt the same way I did. And then, of course, I never heard the word transsexual till a few years later. But somebody who was one gender, who really felt psychologically as another gender, as Christine had in her story, I related to it. And I met Christine years later. In fact, Christine came to my 45th birthday show at Darcell's, and a great, courageous woman. I honor Christine, and I honor her memory. And it was from Christine's story that I first realized that I wasn't alone.
Right. Now, she had a band, too, didn't she?
I don't know.
Yeah, I remember reading somewhere that, more specifically, I believe on the East Coast, she had this band that she toured with. I don't think that it lasted too long, but that was one of the ventures that she was involved with. But I get the idea that She gave you a sense of empowerment.
Definitely. The guy, and when the publicity came out about her, when I was a freshman in high school, some of the kids started teasing me and calling me Christine. The boys especially, you know, I'd be walking down the hall and they'd say, "Hey, Chris." And they called me that. And, you know, I was just being myself. I never, you know, gave any indication to anybody that they just knew. There are some people that are men, for example, who are, when they grow up, they are gay, but they can pass themselves off as straight. But not me. Everybody knew that I was gay. You know, it was just so obvious. You know, I was, and so they started teasing me and calling me Christine and nicknaming me Christine. And when that got back to my dad and my mother especially was very upset about it.
Now, you mention a number of times through the book that, and you've mentioned it several times this morning already, that you felt that as a kid you were quite effeminate. Is being effeminate a state of mind, or is it coupled with physical nuances that a person may have?
A little of both. And it is a state of mind, definitely. But, you know, physically, I have a lot. My legs and arms are very feminine. I've always had very feminine arms, for example. Of course, I did inherit my dad's booming voice, you know, the bass voice. But, you know, my physical characteristics were more effeminate, bass overall, than were masculine. So the only way I'm not an expert or a psychologist, but the only way I can answer your question is I would say a little of both.
Okay. All right. And that does make sense. I mean, I don't think you can color a person effeminate simply because of physical characteristics or because of a mindset.
Well, it was my mannerisms, too. You know?
Sure, sure.
The kids told me that I carried my books like a girl. I don't know. I never even thought of it. The way I carried my books, you know, and right. That I, you know, acted like a girl. When I was in the seventh grade, the high school principal at Rockwood Grade School, and he did not mean this in a complimentary way, he said, "You act more like a girl than girls do." Well, that didn't upset me in the least, but when I went home and told my grandmother, the principal said that, she wasn't too amused about it.
No sense of humor.
Yes, well.
Now, because we don't have time in the 30 minutes that we're on the air here, we're kind of leapfrogging through here. I want to spend just a minute or two, a couple of minutes of time talking about Dr. Harry Benjamin.
Right.
And yes. And the effect that he had on your life. Harry Benjamin was a sexologist.
He's a medical doctor, a sexologist, and endocrinologist, the study of hormones and all that type of thing.
Right. And he was one of the early pioneers
in
the study of transsexuality.
He coined the word transsexual.
Right, right. Now, how did you happen to hear about Dr. Benjamin, and did you feel like you'd found some level of nirvana in that experience?
I met Dr. Harry Benjamin in the early 60s, where it was right after I started living as Paul in 1963 through Laura, a transgender friend of mine. Her and I changed our identity, started living as women at the same time, and she was kind of like a mentor to me, taught me how to wear the makeup and all that. And I learned about Dr. Benjamin from... We were living in Oakland then, and then Dr. Benjamin had two offices, one in New York and one in San Francisco, and he came to San Francisco in the summer to get out of the oppressive heat from New York. So I started going to Dr. Benjamin right after I started working, living as Paula, but it was Laura that told me about Dr. Benjamin, and back then, a man impersonating a woman in public could be arrested, and Dr. Benjamin gave his patients a letter to carry around in case they were stopped by the police, which is published in that letter, is document is in my book. And Dr. Benjamin definition of transsexual was somebody who is psychologically one gender, biologically another. But Dr. Benjamin wrote a book that came out in 1966, The Transsexual Phenomenon. And I, to this day, I don't think there's a better book, more informative book on transsexuality, at least the way I understand it, than that book, The Transsexual Phenomenon. And I was his patient for a year before I moved to Los Angeles, and I was on the hormone shots, you know, a strong estrogen pill every day and a shot a week. And
it was at this time, too, that the clinical community, they were still considering transsexuality as a mental illness.
Yes, they were.
And that had to be a bit of a degrading experience, too.
Well, for me, it really wasn't. I've been very blessed, I guess, that I've just been able to accept myself as I am, even though it went contrary to what society and my family and all that said that I should be. And but Dr. Benjamin was a very compassionate man. And then I went to a different doctor and I went to L.A. And,
yeah.
But on the hormone shots, you know, for breast development and all of that type of stuff, Laura and I used to tease and say, you know, a pill a day keeps the falsies away.
There you go.
In fact, I've entitled a chapter in my book about my experiences with Dr. Benjamin and about, you know, definitions of transsexual and transgender and all that in the chapter. The chapter in my book is called that, A Pill a Day Keeps the Falsies Away.
Right. Now, when you were seeing Dr. Benjamin, and I'm sure that he started talking to you about his standards of care at that time.
Yes.
Did he also administer the test to determine where you fit on the gender scale? You know what I'm talking
yes,
about.
Yes, I do. He has that in his book.
Right.
Yeah, the test, yeah. I don't know what he put me on the gender scale as, quite frankly. I don't remember him ever telling me that. However, you know, on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 meaning somebody just occasionally cross-dresses, and 10 somebody who's had the surgery, I would put Laura, my friend, I put her, give her a 10 on that. I put me about, 8.5.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, let's move up a little bit. 1980s now. You're back in Portland.
Yes.
And you find yourself at Darcel's 15.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, when I first went to San Francisco in the 60s, that my idea was to get a job as a female impersonator at Finocchio's, the famous nightclub there. And, of course, instead of going in that direction, I took the path of the transsexuality, living as Paula. But I came back to Portland in 76, and I heard about Darcel's. I wasn't involved in it then. I was involved in Metropolitan Community Church. But in the early 80s, Christine Jorgensen came to town and had a 3-night engagement at Darcel's, and a group of us from Metropolitan Community Church went to see her show. And then a year later, there's more detail on this in the book, and we're pressed for time. A year later, I made an appearance in a benefit show on a Sunday night at Darcel's, you know, for the Counseling Center for Sexual Minorities, the gay hotline, doing my Sophie Tucker recitation. I had learned Sophie Tucker's material years before. You'll have to get the book for that, too. I don't have to get into it. And then I started appearing there on once a week in a show called Catch a Rising Star. And then eventually I started filling in for Darcel doing the stand-up comedy. And it's interesting because at Darcel's, I was there as an entertainer. Then when I started the Sister Paula Public Access television show in the late 80s, I was there as a preacher. The public access show was kind of a combination of both, but Darcel would have to remind me once in a while. She'd say, Paula, people are not paying a cover charge to be preached to. And I love to entertain. The three things I love to do is preach, write, and entertain.
Okay. Couple of real quick questions. First one, and to our listeners, I will readily admit we have not covered very much of the book, but we've glossed over what I think are some highlights in the book that make it a very readable book and a very enjoyable book.
It covers 7 decades.
Right. That's a span of time. one do you miss or wish that you'd had more time as Larry?
No. No, Paula is who I am. There were certain things about my life in the gay male community as a young fairy and stuff that I did kind of miss a little bit. But by and large, though, I've never regretted making the decision to change my identity from Larry to Paula. Like I said in my intro in the book, I've made a few poor choices, but that wasn't one of them. But I did not miss, as a young fairy, being tolerated once I got real, true, genuine acceptance as Paula.
Okay. Very quick, because we're just about out of time. Where can folks find your book?
They can find it on Create Space and Amazon. We're working on getting it in the Powell's bookstore. That you can go out. So to make it brief, my webpage is sisterpaula.org, O-R-G, sisterpaula.org. It has links to Create Space and Amazon where you can order the book, or you can send me a check in the mail. It's got the address there, and I'll send you a personal signed copy. Or I carry them around with me, and we have a book signing coming up on May the 3rd. At Metropolitan Community Church here in Portland when I'm celebrating my 50th anniversary of living as Paula.
Okay. Paula, thank you very much. Paula Nielsen, my guest. She is the author of The Trans Evangelist, The Life and Times of a Transgender Pentecostal Preacher. You try saying that 10 times real fast, let me tell you. It's a mouthful. And to our many listeners, thank you very much for listening. If you are not a member of the great KBOO community, you can do so by going online right now to kboo.fm and click on the tip jar and declare your membership as a part of this great community. That's Between the Covers for today. I'm Dan Johnson. Thank you for listening.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Also, thanks to a grant. Also, thanks to a grant from Merrillhurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and I'm joined on the phone today from Seattle by acclaimed alternative cartoonist and graphic novelist, Ben Katcher. He's touring behind his new book, Hand Drawing in America and Other Stories. Ben Katcher, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, how are you? Sorry I can't be there in person.
Yes, I hear that you were supposed to be at Powell City of Books, and people were looking forward to seeing you, and your flight got derailed out of Chicago.
Yeah, so it's the second cancellation. The first one was due to the book printing problems. The book was delayed a little bit. I'll get there in the fall, if possible.
Well, tell us about the tour that you're going on, this book tour for Hand Drawing in America and Other Stories. What do you like about touring behind your books?
Oh, I like that. I mean, a book is kind of this strange remove from the reader. So a book tour makes it a little bit more like theater. I do recitations of my strips with projections, and there's a kind of making the strips back into theater. So I like that. I mean, otherwise, a book sits on a shelf, you know, in 50 years somebody might open it and laugh at something. but I won't be there to hear it. So I like the immediacy of having the audience hearing my strips and how they react to them.
Well, let's talk about, if I can embarrass you a little bit with all of these accolades here, you are the first cartoonist to have received a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship grant back in 2000. You've gotten a Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Fellowship in 1995. And in addition to your cartooning and your publishing, you've also had some theater experience. You've gotten a couple of Obie Awards. You had a comic book opera called The Carbon Copy Building and a sort of absurdist romance called The Slugbearers of Carole Island.
Yeah, I've done about 5 music theater shows with Mark Mulcahy. He's the musician who a lot of people know from the Pete and Pete TV show and other in his Miracle Legion. Yeah, we've done about 5 shows, and we're about to start another one. So it's a text and image thing, like comics. It's probably the first place where text and image was combined before the invention of print, in the theater. The actor walks out onto the stage, forms a stage picture, and then opens his mouth, and there's the text. So it's comics are definitely in that tradition.
What is it about the opera form that appeals to you? Is there a formalism that
music theater? Yeah, I think there's a music to human speech that we're not always conscious of in spoken language, and I like when someone can just crank it up another 10 or 20%. So you say, wait a minute, that person is singing. He's not just talking. And it's this kind of, again, a kind of very heightened, you're very self-conscious about the theatrics of the thing or the artificiality of the whole construct. That's what I like about it.
And there's definitely something theatrical about your comics. I remember many, many years ago seeing your weekly comic strip, Julius Knippel, Real Estate Photographer, in the alternative newspapers. And it was almost a throwback. You use pencil and pen and watercolor washes. And there's a very, as we were saying, a very theatrical action. Some readers characterize your comics as wordy. There's certainly no shortage of dialogue and narration. Characters often narrate the action. But I notice in your strips there's also a formality and a cadence to the language. To me, it's like David Mamet meets the Old Testament.